Seconds.
Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. This is Shirley Stolzer along with Flo Joseph interviewing for the second time Dr. Barbara Schuer at her office on Wednesday afternoon, February 10, 1993. Dr. Schuer, would you just state your name so we'll know that you're coming across?
Right, here I am. I'm Barbara K. Schuer.
Thank you.
Does that do it?
Flo, you had some questions for Dr. Schuer.
I just want to be sure we have your birth date.
Ma'am.
Birth date?
Yes.
Okay, November 26, 1920.
I also would like to have the names of your father and mother.
Okay, my father was Benjamin Morris, spelled M-A-U-R-I-C-E, Kramer. And my mother was Cecilia Shapiro Kramer.
Okay. And we know at the end of our last session, we know you were married in 1942, and at that time you had just graduated the School of Social Work here at Pitt, at Margaret Morrison. And your husband, or husband-to-be at that time, was in the engineering school and he had graduated.
No, he graduated that December of 1942.
December 42. And you were finished in June 42.
Right.
I see. And you, between the time that you graduated and you and he finished his course, were you married in the meantime?
We were married in December. Right after he graduated.
Right after he graduated. Were you married here in Pittsburgh?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Could you tell me a little bit of what went on? Was it a big ceremony? Was it a small family gathering?
It was a small family gathering. We had it at Rabbi Freehoff's study. He lived over here in the Ruskin Apartments then, where he had lived for many years. Mm-hmm. And we had to have it there because it was Christmas Day that we got married, and that was because it was the first day of the beginning of vacation from school. I was here, had started the master's program here in September, and so that was our first day that we could get married and have a little holiday, and there was no one to open up the temple that day, so we had to go to the rabbi's study.
I see.
And we had present there just immediate family. Mm-hmm. Then we had a luncheon afterwards over here at the Hotel Shenley, and then my mother had a reception at her house, mm-hmm. at their house, mm-hmm. my mother and father's house, mm-hmm. right after that.
So in December 42, you had 6 months of...
From September on, I had one semester.
One semester of school social.
Right.
And you continued, though, after your marriage.
Yes.
To finish in 2 years, or was it shorter term?
No, it was 2 years, but because it was wartime, they accelerated us, and we went straight through the summer, and I graduated in January of 1944. Rather than in June of 44.
I see, January 44.
But that was because they accelerated the classes because of the war.
And what was your husband doing while you were?
He was working on a research project over at Carnegie, was then Carnegie Tech. A rubber research project try to create artificial rubber, since rubber was such a problem during the war. And he worked there until we finished, and then we went to Chicago where he began his graduate work.
Tell me, I haven't heard much about your husband. Is he a Pittsburgher? Did he have family here too?
Mm-hmm. He is a Pittsburgher, and he has family here. He had his mother and father, of course, had a grandmother here, and who had died in the early 40s. And has four siblings, one sister and three brothers, all of whom live in Pittsburgh now, except the one brother who lives in San Francisco.
I see. Now, where did he come in the line?
He was the second of five.
Second of five. Did all the children go to the university?
Yes.
They all are graduates of the University
of University of Pittsburgh. Right.
And the ones who remained here, was there a close family between your family and
your husband's family? As a matter of fact, we lived with Jack's folks after we got married until I finished graduate school and we left Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. So we had
I guess
very
that was
close.
Not unusual at that time.
No, I think
it is
it was
now.
Rather typical. Right.
Right.
And it was very handy for everybody.
It was.
I hope for them, it certainly was for us.
Uh-huh. You were relaxed there.
I loved it.
Good, good. And when you left for Chicago in 1944, what did you, when you got to Chicago, your husband, you said, started graduate school. What were you doing?
I then worked at Chicago State Hospital for a year plus, and then went to work for Jewish Children's Bureau in Chicago.
Now, when you got your degree in social work, was that for hospital social work or generic?
Well, it was
generic?
Supposed to be psychiatric social work, which is why I worked for a year, a little over a year, in a state hospital, because you had to do that to get qualified as a psychiatric social worker then. We don't have those differentiations now, but they did then, and that was a requirement that you have a year of experience post-master's in order to be a member of the Association of Psychiatric Social Workers.
I see. And was the program at this hospital what would be considered a good program for teaching and your learning and so forth?
Oh, I think so. I think it was a well-known hospital, and they were used to having students and welcomed students. It was a large social service department. We had about, I think, at least 20 social
you
workers.
Did.
Because we were responsible for all of the mental patients that were discharged into the Chicago area, whether they came from Chicago State Hospital or other state hospitals.
I see.
So there was a very large caseload.
Uh-huh. And was the social work field a relatively open one at that time, or was it difficult to get positions?
No, it was wartime, and there were great needs. And no, I had no difficulty at all.
You just applied and went in there and had a position.
Right.
Was this your position of preference, to be at a hospital?
Well, I had to have the psychiatric experience for a year to qualify for membership in the Psychiatric Social Workers Association, so that was one of the preferences.
Mm-hmm. And you stayed there just 1 year?
I stayed there just a little over a year. Mm-hmm. It was the opposite end of Chicago from where we lived. It took me an hour and a half to get there each day, an hour and a half to get home, so I was not displeased with deciding to change. The work was fine, and I got good supervision
mm-hmm.
and it was a nice group of people to work with, but the distance was just overwhelming, and the time spent traveling was overwhelming.
Right.
It was exactly the at the northwest corner of Chicago, and we lived in the southeast section of Chicago near the University of Chicago, where my husband was in school. And so then I shifted to Jewish Children's Bureau, whose office was downtown, and it was considerably closer. It was an excellent agency.
It was. Did it also have many workers and clientele?
Yes, it was a really
busy
agency.
Was it only for Jewish children?
Yes. They never merged, I don't know that they ever did, with Jewish Family Agency the way it's happened in most other cities like here.
Right.
They never did, and I don't think they have to this day, to the best of my knowledge, merged. They certainly didn't in our day.
Now, what was the nature of that? Was that placement?
We had children in an institution, an orphanage, Mark's Nathan Orphanage.
What was the name of
Mark's Nathan, which was a pretty well-known place, and was in the process of closing out the, it was then the period of time in history when we didn't have orphanages anymore.
Right.
So, and I became the worker in Marchnathan and did the planning and the transfer of children till we closed it down.
I see. Where did you transfer the children to?
We had the agency opened, and they were the first, I think, in the country to do this, residential treatment centers.
Wow.
As many as we could, we got back home with families, because although it was called an orphanage by that period of history, most children weren't really orphans.
Yes, I was going to ask you, what did they define orphans?
Well, originally it was orphans because people died sooner, but it really was families that could not manage to take care of their children.
Financially or emotionally?
Mostly emotionally, mm-hmm. not so much financially. They did have foster placement also, and they did adoption work. Mm-hmm. But these were kids that had been placed in this institution. Many of them had been there for many, many years. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of adolescents who had been there from ages 5 or so, but they were children whose families would not give them up, would not
allow them
be placed. And mostly there were often two parents, neither of them able to really take care of the children, or one parent who couldn't manage.
And now, did you work with the children at the institution, or with the parents, or both?
Mostly with the children, but certainly with the parents in relation to planning. Because we were in the process of transferring all of the children.
Well, when you were in the process of transferring, were you thinking in terms of whether the family could really meet the emotional needs of the child?
Whether they were capable of doing that.
I see. And if not, did you have where to put them?
Then, well, we put them in residential treatment centers, and some went into foster homes. Most of them did not go into adoptive homes, because the families would not release them. Had the families been willing to release them, many of them would have been adopted much earlier. And so they went either into our residential treatment centers that we were in the process of opening, small group homes, but with a focus on treatment, or into foster homes.
That was far thinking to have these kinds of small homes.
Yes,
because
they were the first. Exactly. I think they were the first, as far as I knew, first agency in the country that did plan and do residential treatment centers. Mm-hmm. And then after we...
Excuse me, about the residential treatment center, they weren't treating the children.
Yes.
They were.
Well, these were children. The children that tended to get put in those homes were children where it was felt that there had been some damage emotionally, and that they needed treatment.
They actually did get treatement,
psychological treatment. Yes, we had psychiatric treatment as well as social work treatment for them. Then after, just before we left Chicago, but after we had moved all the children out, we got a load, as they did all over the country, of children who were left in concentration camps when the war was over. And Truman had done an executive order that permitted children who were the only ones of their family to survive and had been found in the camps to be brought into this country, and the Jewish, where they were Jewish, the Jewish agencies in each city took responsibility.
I see.
And we got about 150 of those children. And I was the worker then for those kids until we left Chicago. And that was a truly amazing experience.
I can imagine, because the children didn't speak English.
No.
And what, mostly German?
No, mostly Eastern European.
Eastern European. And you
overwhelmingly, they were Eastern European.
And you were able to communicate?
Well, we managed.
Uh-huh. Now, were they put into treatment centers like the other ones, or were you placing them in homes, private homes?
Neither. We kept them in the institution until we could work out arrangements for them to go out and live on their own. We rarely placed them. These were not kids that were very placeable.
Yes.
And they were very resistive to anyone trying to be very close to them.
Yes, they had a hard time. What was the age range that you had?
Well, they were supposed to be, by the executive order, under 18. All of these were boys, no girls, that had survived, apparently, as it was all boys.
That's unusual.
Well, I don't know. I think the girls probably were. These were tough boys. I think they were kids that you knew.
They survived.
Had to survive, and did, and they were big and tended to be brawny, and most of them had lost their front teeth, and We don't know quite how, whether it was just cavities or whether they had been utilized. And they were eager to get on their own. I mean, there were millions of people in Chicago who wanted these kids. We did not, and the psychiatrist that was working with us did not feel they were adoptable at all. They were too old, first of all. They were, who knows if they were even under 18. They were supposed to be, but
right,
they didn't really know, and we didn't know,
right.
So somebody took their word for it. And so we worked with them in the direction of helping them to really get on their own, and sometimes they did go to live with families while they were either doing training, schooling of various sorts, or went out on their own to work. But they were eager to get on their own. I mean, they really pushed for that.
And was the Jewish community supporting the payment for jobs?
Overwhelmingly.
The
Jewish community just...
They came across?
Doted on them and wanted them to be one of them.
Did they do anything in wanting them to be one of them? Do anything to instill some sense of themselves as Jews, Jewish boys? Did the Jewish community reach out in that way to involve them in Jewish
But these
Jewish
kids
activities?
Knew they were Jewish.
They did.
I mean, there was no question. They had been kept in camps where it was overwhelmingly Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And although they didn't know a lot about observances and whatever, they had very little education of any sort.
Right.
They certainly had a Jewish consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
They were aware they were Jewish.
But I wondered in terms of holidays and stuff, did the Jewish community take them to their homes for the holidays and introduce them to synagogue?
Very much so. In fact, they were overwhelmingly eager to take these kids into their homes. We resisted placing them for long-term placement because the feeling was that they were really not suitable for that.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them didn't really want that, and most of them certainly didn't want to be close. They didn't want a lot of intimacy at all. It was very clear that they did not trust people.
Was that with adults or with peers too?
Well, I think with each other too, except there was a huge bond between them, of course.
Well, but you had other children in that place.
We had over
150. Did they...
I think so. I mean, as far as I could tell, I think they supported each other.
Mm-hmm.
But their major desire was to get out on their own, to make money. They had trust in material things and no trust in people at all.
That's interesting.
And you would expect that.
Yes, absolutely.
Overwhelmingly so. Mm-hmm. We had an interesting follow-up because we left Chicago in 1947, and I turned that caseload over to another worker who by then didn't see again until the early 70s when I ran into her at an ortho meeting.
Mm-hmm.
She had by then left Chicago, was at Jewish Board of Guardians in New York. And so we instantly sat down, and I had thought about those children all those years, what happened to them. It was really interesting because in the 60s, they started to show up in the agency in larger than expected numbers, having real trouble with their adolescents who were American adolescents. And you think of the 60s and what kids were thinking about then. It was very clear they were not overly enamored of adults, certainly. And had no real attachment to material things, which for the parents was what mattered. I mean, that was all you could trust.
Right.
You certainly could trust people.
Mm-hmm.
So you trusted the solidity of material
mm-hmm.
things. And most of them had worked very hard and been quite prosperous. They did very well, but the kids had nothing but contempt for that.
Mm-hmm.
And what Evelyn told me was that when the agency began to explore with the parents what was going on, it was very clear that that was one of the major dysfunctions that was occurring, was that the kids really had contempt for what their parents respected, which was material things, and had no idea of what their parents' background was. When the agency explored with them how much they had ever shared with the kids what their life was like, they had not shared at all.
Mm-hmm.
So the kids had no way of knowing or understanding why their parents were as they were.
Focused on material.
And when the agency began to talk to them about the importance of sharing with the children something of their background. Most of them said we could never do that.
Yes.
We could never let them know what we had to do to survive. Oh. We could not talk to them about it.
It's too hurtful.
This is surprising because most people at that area were fixed on material things. They're out of, I mean, many of them were anyhow in World War II. They came back. They had to learn to live in families.
Well,
and so they had,
it is,
you know,
for our Americans.
Hmm?
Yeah, you mean for the
Americans.
But then they
yes.
also had all these
so
conflicts
just,
with their adolescent
mm-hmm.
kids in the 60s.
Yes.
I mean, that
I
was,
think
the conflict that they were having with their adolescents.
I think
this
was
more intense, Evelyn
right,
said,
oh,
than
sure.
it was with American kids.
It must have been very difficult for these parents who had come over as children themselves and going through so much, to see their children where they're willing to give them so much,
mm-hmm.
not be grateful, not be happy for
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also interesting that they came back to the agency for help.
Yeah.
So somewhere you
there
hit
was
a chord.
A tie.
You
uh-huh.
hit a chord.
All right.
And they knew this is the place we come for
right.
help.
Yeah. So they came in large numbers.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was very interesting, I thought, very important.
Yes.
I think in the follow-up research I've seen that's been done with survivors,
mm-hmm.
that many of them don't talk to their children about it at all. Now, many talk mm-hmm. endlessly and drive their children, frankly, crazy over, you know, never
yes.
Removing the focus from that terrible experience, but many of them did not. And this was a prime
yes.
sample of the group that did not.
Well, it's only in recent years, actually, in the last 10 years, that people have started
begun
to open
to talk.
Up. Children of Holocaust survivors
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
have come together to talk.
Right.
It's been a whole
right.
opening, so
yes.
to speak.
Oh, yes.
But you were
true.
In among the first.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right.
You weren't, you didn't, weren't at that agency when the families came to the States to be resettled. You didn't do any of that.
No.
That was
no.
the Jewish
And I think Jewish Family Service
right.
would have done whatever
right.
that was. We just got the kids.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have
So
families.
You stayed how long at that agency?
Well, I was there from early 40, what was that, 44? From late 44 to late 47, almost 3 years.
And then you left only because your husband?
Because we moved. He finished his work and we moved to Rochester, New York.
I see. Was this a master's program he was in?
Well, he finished it with a master's and
I
still had his doctoral work to finish.
So he went on to Rochester?
No, we went on to work in Rochester. He left and I was pregnant by then with our first child, and he worked at Olin Matheson Chemical Company
yes.
up in Niagara Falls. But we lived, well, first he worked with Hayloyd in Rochester. And then he transferred to Buffalo to Olin Matheson
there.
And worked
mm-hmm.
there. But we were in Rochester about a year, and our first child was born there.
In Rochester?
In Rochester.
Uh-huh. What year was that?
Well, she was born in June of 47.
What was her name?
Erica.
Erica.
Mm-hmm.
And where is Erica now?
Erica's in Berkeley, California now.
And she is doing?
She's a social worker and a lawyer.
Oh, she followed up you.
Yeah, she became a lawyer first and then recently got her master's at Berkeley and is working in Children and Youth Services, which they call something else.
Yes.
She's working in one of those special projects on permanency placement for children where they put workers in the homes to stay with the family for an intensive short period.
Initially,
to prevent the breakup of homes.
Right.
And she's the supervisor of a unit that's doing that. And
that's interesting.
It is. It's very interesting.
That's a whole new concept.
Uh-huh.
I don't
uh-huh.
think we do that here yet.
Well, we're doing some of it with Children
yeah.
and Youth Services,
limited.
But they were one of the first that took that project. It's family. It's not even reunification, it's family unification. Because they're trying to prevent the children from being removed by doing intensive work.
Mm-hmm. Is she married?
Yes, and she has three children.
Three children, what are their ages?
Well, Jennifer, who is now in Guatemala, but is a senior at Santa Cruz, is 21. And Benjamin, who's a sophomore, grandpa is 19 and Lily is 17. She will graduate from high school this year.
Oh. And what does your son-in-law do? What kind of?
Well, she's in the midst of being divorced, but the father of the children's a pediatrician.
Oh, he's a pediatrician.
And she's going to be getting married this August, is the matter. She just set the date to a young man who's a teacher.
Good. Did she make
high school teacher that lives at Berkeley.
Good. So it's a whole new family starting up now.
Mm-hmm.
Of addition.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, what did you start to work in Buffalo when you came?
No. We had Ricky in Rochester, and I didn't work. I just waited for the baby to be born and did not work. And then we went to Buffalo, and I didn't work. And then we came back to Pittsburgh about 4 years later, and I didn't work then until our youngest was entering kindergarten.
Oh.
So now, I had about 13 years when I didn't work.
I see. And in that 13 years, you had other children.
I had three more children.
Can you tell us about
them? Yes. Deborah is 2 years younger than Ricky, and she lives in Washington, D.C., and she has two little boys, a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old, and she's the executive director of an agency called the Sasha Bruce Youth Work Agency, which has a runaway house, has group homes for teen mothers, and works with status offenders and does outreach work with street kids.
That's a private agency?
Yeah, but they have a number of government contracts.
They do.
Are you pleased that the three generations have all
there they
in
are.
The same area?
Yeah, right, And it's a big agency.
It is.
And has grown and grown and grown.
Can you say the name again?
Sasha Bruce. S-A-S-H-A Bruce. B-R-U-C-E. Youth Works. It's named for the child, the daughter of the woman who's the widow of David Bruce, who used to be the ambassador to the Soviet Union, and her daughter was killed, they think killed this man who presumably did this, who was her husband, claimed that she committed suicide, but in any case they do not believe that. And she had done a great deal of youth work, and so she then endowed this agency so that they could buy the house and get started.
Sasha. Oh, Sasha.
Daughter.
I see.
And she was called Sasha because she was born, I think, when they were in the Soviet Union.
Yes.
When he was the ambassador. Mm-hmm. It also been, he was the first husband of Ilsa Mellon Bruce.
Yes,
from the Mellon family here. And this is his second wife. Mm-hmm. And she has remained very involved with the agency and with the board. And Debbie's the only executive they've had, so she helped found it and has worked.
How many years has that been?
Oh, it's probably, I've lost track, I would think at least 15, 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
But she was in college at the time and just had come out of Antioch at Columbia, Maryland, and became the first exec.
Mm-hmm.
And the only.
And the only exec. But the agency has expanded under her?
Oh, enormously.
Mm-hmm. How long has she been there for?
Well, I think, trying to figure, must be at least close to 18, 19 years.
She's really
been there quite a while.
Yes, yes. And her husband?
Well, she's divorced. Her husband worked in youth work also.
He was also in the same
And
area.
He does now international youth work.
Mm-hmm. Now, did she start this as a social worker, with a social work degree?
She doesn't have a social work degree. She has a degree from Antioch, undergraduate degree, and it was in urban studies and black studies.
I see.
And she's taken some master's work at Catholic U, but she's never had time to finish it.
But she's had a lot of experience to contribute.
Yes, and she will eventually. She wants to eventually get back. It's just been difficult.
Sure.
With the heavy duty work at the agency, plus the kids, plus whatever.
Yes. And how about the next child?
Our third child is our son, and he is lives in Durham, North Carolina. He's a biostatistician. He got his doctorate at Chapel Hill, and his wife did also. That's where they met.
I see.
And they both work in that area. She's at Duke, mm-hmm. and he is with the research arm of the EPA in the Research Triangle Park, and they have two children,
mm-hmm.
And almost four and at almost two.
Oh, they're much younger.
Very young.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I didn't get how old your second daughter. When was she
born?
Well,
she was born in 49. Rick was born in 47, and Debbie in 49, and our son in 51, and our youngest daughter in 54.
Uh-huh. And your youngest daughter?
Is a lawyer, and she's in Tucson, Arizona.
What is her name?
Her name is Bonnie, Bonita. And she practices law in Tucson, and she's married, has her husband's a high school teacher of special children, special ed.
Oh, I see.
And they have four children, four boys.
Oh, boy. Boys predominate.
Overwhelmingly. The
yeah,
only
right.
girls are the two oldest,
uh-huh.
you know, Ricky's children. All the others are boys. And Bonnie's oldest boy has muscular dystrophy. So he's highly disabled.
He's at home?
Oh, yes. Yes, he's 10. You know, he goes to public school.
Yes.
But he is increasingly more and more disabled, as happens with muscular dystrophy. So that's been a real difficult
yes,
one.
Yes,
right.
I'm sure. How does your husband feel not one of the children came into the engineering field
and chemistry.
You predominated
right.
in this?
Well, he would love to have had one of them become a chemist.
Right.
He would